Welcome back to Money in America with Randall Turner. Today, my special guest is Ted DeHaven. He's a budget analyst on federal and state budget issues for Cato Institute. And he's had some fascinating experiences. The one I got a kick out of here, he's also a policy analyst for the National Taxpayers Union. Good morning. Welcome aboard, Ted.
Good morning, Randall. Thank you for having me on.
Well, we're excited. You obviously are deep into the federal budget issues, and I think we need education. Yeah, I know that's a big, complex subject, but if you could just narrow it down into a couple sentences or a paragraph, where does the federal budget stand today? Where should it be? How's that? Can we? Is that too big a statement?
There's no doubt about it. The federal budgeting is a very, very complex issue. Part of the reason why is it's so big. We're closing in on $4 trillion as the size of our federal budget. The last couple of years, we've been running annual deficits in excess of $1 trillion. And so that's why the national debt is skyrocketing. And the scary part is because our budget consists largely now of entitlements, we're heading into a situation where folks are going to be retiring, particularly the baby boomers. They're expecting certain benefits, and we're going to have fewer people out in the workforce working to pay the taxes to fund those deficits. So we have an imbalance that's only going to get worse. And so the question is, what are we going to do about it?
And is there an easy answer to what are we doing?
Well, no, there's not an easy answer, because at the end of the day, the federal budget is about politics. Washington is about politics. The folks in charge of making these decisions have a very short-term attention span. They're focused on the next election cycle. They're not necessarily focused on what's good for the long-term growth of the country. So when you get into these big, important programs like Social Security, Medicare, these are the biggest budget busters. These are the programs that need to be reined in, or else we're going to be in a lot of trouble. And unfortunately, politicians generally are afraid to tackle those because they're extremely popular with the American people. A lot of the American people are dependent on these programs. And so in my view, it's really important to educate the American people to understand the dangers we're facing, to understand that these programs that they've come to know and love and take for granted represent a tremendous burden, and in particular a burden that we're about to foist on our children and grandchildren, and we're setting them up for a future of reduced living standards. And so I think it's a moral question. And if politicians are only going to gather the gumption to do the right thing if the American people are willing to support them and tell them to go do the right thing.
So, boy, that's a big – it brings up a lot of thoughts. We've got Tea Party members of Congress now. We've got the more liberal Republicans in, and you obviously have your much more liberal Democrats in. A lot of them say the right thing. Even some of the Democrats are now saying the right thing. Do you think there's actually enough gumption to actually make it happen to reduce the spending on all these different fronts, or is it still a little pipe dream?
Well, I don't want to say it's a pipe dream, but there's certainly more momentum for spending cuts. The problem is spending cuts can mean a lot of things. It can mean a few spending cuts, a sufficient amount of spending cuts, a lot of spending cuts, and you have to get specific. One of the issues I picked up on before the election with the Tea Party is the Tea Party folks seem to appreciate and understand that federal spending has gotten out of control. So you see a lot of placards and signs saying reduce spending, shrink government. But there's not a lot of knowledge of actually what kind of spending needs to be cut. And until folks get specific with Washington and say, look, I don't want my farm subsidies anymore. The Department of Education, I understand that they're not helping educate my kids at all, that more money in the classrooms isn't the solution. Until people recognize that the federal government is not the solution to their problems, and understand they've been conditioned to believe that over the last half century or more. The federal government is so involved in our lives down to the point of telling us what kind of light bulbs we can use. And these are big, complex issues. And when you talk about a nearly $4 trillion budget, you're talking about thousands of programs. And each one of those programs has a building constituency. And these building constituencies have an incentive, an economic, personal incentive to spend time, money, and energy making sure that Congress continues to fund their, and grow their programs. Those benefits are concentrated on people, on groups. But the cost of these programs are dispersed across, you know, hundreds of millions of American taxpayers. And so, you know, when Joe or Jane Worker comes home at night, they're thinking about having dinner, maybe going to their kid's basketball game, relaxing, reading the newspaper, a book. Very rarely are they going to come home and say, you know what, I understand we have this budget problem. I'm going to go read about farm subsidies tonight. I'm going to learn about it, and then I'm going to devote time and money and resources to get my member of Congress to vote against it. It just it doesn't happen.
Right.
And that's the special interest nature of the federal budget. I think we need to look at the federal budget as this giant piece of pie. And it's carved up into innumerable slices. And until we get better education amongst the public and a willingness to understand and accept that we don't need the federal government to do everything that it does, that's going to be very hard to apply enough pressure in Washington to get the votes and the signature in the White House to implement the cuts we need to reduce the size and scope of the federal government.
Let's try to... I don't know. Make this down to the numbers side of my brain. What is Greece was debt to GDP? Greece was roughly 120%, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they fell apart, and we all know what happened there. Where does America stand in the same kind of ratio, debt to GDP?
We're heading towards 90%, and that's considered by some economists to be the danger level. Now, other countries like Japan, they've been running at I think close to 200%. And they've been able to get away with it. The American, United States government gets away with it because the country's seen as a stable, secure place. They trust the debt. Investors, foreign, domestic, don't really have to worry about default. And so it's been very easy for the federal government to fund its profligacy because it can issue debt relatively cheaply. The danger comes when these pressures build and build to a point that investors, again, whether domestic or foreign, decide, yeah, I'm getting a little bit concerned about this. And they start to get concerned maybe the Federal Reserve is going to step in and just start monetizing the debt and then weakening the dollar. So maybe they start to want to ask for higher interest rates. And see, it's when the interest rates start to get higher, that's the cost of borrowing to the federal government. That's where the danger sets in because it becomes a compounding effect because obviously the higher the cost to borrow, the more money you have to spend financing that debt. And so your interest cost alone become a tremendous burden that squeezes out money for other federal programs.
Do you know what that amount costs us as a percentage of the federal budget now? What does the interest cost?
Right now it's I think only a couple hundred billion. I say only a couple hundred billion dollars, but according to projections from the Congressional Budget Office, assuming things kind of stay the same, we do get some sort of an economic recovery. We're looking at potential interest costs in 2020 of $1 trillion a year.
Out of a current $4 trillion budget. So you're telling me
quarter. At
right
that point in 2020, you're probably looking at $5 to $6 trillion. Again, these are long-range estimates.
But it'll still be 20% versus
today. Estimates are,
today's are, roughly 5%, right? I mean, you're telling me $200 billion, give or take. Out of a $4 trillion, that's roughly 5% of our budget is paying interest, of which I imagine the majority of that actually is being shipped overseas, that interest money, right?
Yeah, about half of it. About half of it, yes.
And so if you have an increase in the interest rate from whatever it is now, at give or take 3%, and if it goes up to the historical norm, which is closer to 5%, you're going to almost double your interest payment. So suddenly you're not 5% of your federal budget, you're 10% of your federal budget. I mean,
and that's,
ballpark
that's
numbers.
A good,
ballpark.
Yeah, and that's a good point, and that's the danger is if the cost of borrowing takes off, the trillion-dollar figure I just cited could be a heck of a lot worse. And so the longer Washington waits to get something done, the bigger and the more difficult the challenge becomes. Unfortunately, the excuse, and my goodness, politicians are always looking for an excuse not to make the tough decisions, is that we're still coming out of a recession, and it would be too dangerous to cut federal spending now because that would somehow hurt the economy. And that's one of the biggest canards that I'm focusing on right now, and trying to make the counter-argument that, hey, let's not forget that everything the federal government spends on, it has to take from the private sector, whether it taxes or borrows it out of the economy. There's no such thing as a free lunch. So you have to consider the cost of everything the federal government does, not just the purported benefits.
There seems to be a tremendous
amount of research out there that shows that cutting spending is actually good.
Right.
And freeing up the private sector. You know, the private sector has been sitting on the sideline to some degree. We hear an awful lot about businesses hoarding cash. Well, there's tremendous uncertainty with the political climate in Washington, and they're concerned about union protections. They're concerned about higher taxes. They're concerned about cap and trade and all these other regulations, financial regulations.
Right.
So the best thing we could do in terms of the economy is shrink the government's footprint in the economy and create some sort of certainty so that the entrepreneurs and business folks and risk takers are willing to go out and invest and hire and get the economy going.
Well, Ted, there's been an awful lot of discussion about raising the debt ceiling. Can you shed some light on that?
Well, the whole hullabaloo over the debt ceiling is largely political. I recently blogged on this because the administration came out and warned basically Republicans that Republicans, in exchange for voting for an increase in the debt limit, are saying we need, you know, to get our vote, we need to institute some cuts and structural reforms in the budget process. And the administration comes out and says, you're basically playing a game of chicken with the economy. If we don't raise the debt limit, we could default, world catastrophe, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Well, back in 2006, one of the numerous times that they've raised the debt ceiling this decade, when the president was a senator from Chicago and Republicans were in control, Senator Obama voted against raising the debt ceiling. And so it's a political hot potato. There's not going to be any default. There's all kinds of things that the government can do to avoid a default. And so the argument that we just merely need to continue business as usual, continue raising the debt ceiling, and not tackle the spending and necessary budget reforms is frankly a bunch of hooey.
Thank you. I mean, you get so confused. You watch the evening news, you watch the network news, and oh my gosh, the world is going to end if we don't raise the debt ceiling. And I've really tried to figure out the logic of that. How is it that the one I forget the congressman's name, but he was on one of those networks saying that if you didn't raise the debt ceiling, you would not be able to sell new bonds. And boy, that confused the daylights out of me. How does the one relate to the other? You're not selling new bonds. You're only going to sell the amount that you're allowed to by law, which means you can't roll over as many. But there's other, I've read there's creative ways for them to pick up an extra $400 billion somewhere else by doing various accounting tricks, if you will.
Well, more simply than that is just because you're up against the debt limit doesn't mean the tax revenues aren't coming in. And so it becomes what do you spend money on first. And actually, new Senator Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania is going to introduce legislation that basically says, in the case that we reach the debt limit, the first thing the federal government has to do is pay interest obligations. And that's where the politics come into it. The government will have enough money to pay the interest now. It won't have the money to pay for all the programs, but that's a separate discussion. So my point is the alarmism that the White House is creating, insisting that we really can't worry about spending reforms and budgetary reforms, and that we should just merely increase the debt limit without doing so, again, is nonsense. There's ways around it.
Well, Ted, this has been very helpful, but unfortunately, I think we're about out of time. This has been Ted DeHaven. DeHaven? Did I say that right?
Yes.
DeHaven.
Uh-huh.
With the Cato Institute, and this is Money in America with Randall Turner.